From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Text, tweet, post, watch, blog, reblog, repeat. For millions, billions now. That's the digital cycle of daily life. We've got a digital tether, a digital fixation in every minute of the day, every twitch of our brains, it can seem. What's the upshot? What's the alternative? Big thinking journalist and travel writer Pico Iyer is on it, opting out of the digital frenzy. This hour on Point, Pico Iyer on going unplugged. You can join the conversation. How do you find the right balance of plugging in and tuning out? And are you tempted to cut the cord? Is that really an option? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Santa Barbara, California, is Pico Iyer, essayist, journalist, travel writer, author of The Open Road, The Global Soul, Abandon. His latest book out this month is a memoir and meditation on the writer, Graham Greene. It's The Man Within My Head. Pico Iyer, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here again.
It's wonderful to have you with us. So, we've thought about a lot, the impact of digital technology at this point. We're into some, I don't know, what is it, third or fourth or tenth sort of iteration of our contemplation of what it does to us and our response to it. And you're seeing more and more people respond by moving away from it, as I read you, Pico.
Yes, I think so many people are almost ODing now. And I think whenever something new comes into our life, the first thing we see is the world it opens up to us, all the things it allows us to do that we couldn't do before. But slowly we begin to see all the things that it doesn't change and all the things that it can't do. And I've noticed with my friends, when we talk about cars or TV, when they came into the world, they seemed revolutionary, and they were revolutionary. But now, many decades on, we've noticed that when we think of cars, we think of traffic jams and pollution. When we think of TVs, we think of distractibility or passivity. And I think with cell phones and the internet, this whole cycle has played out, of course, much more quickly. So within about 20 years, we're already beginning to realize how much is enough and how do we begin to carve out some freedom of our own amidst all the freedoms they've given us.
Are we 21st century human beings really extractable from all that digital technology? I mean, it seems to me very often that as tight as we became with cars and television, just for two examples, I see an awful lot of people who are even more tightly wired in to their many, many digital gizmos.
Of course, and our life and our living depend on them. And yet I think some of us find that if we're trying to deal with 100 things, we can't deal with any single one of them. And so to some extent, those of my friends who are texting and tweeting and talking to on the phone at the same time aren't really giving themselves to anyone, and the person on the other end is probably feeling a little short-shrifted. So I often think to myself that 15 years ago, for example, I lived completely happily without a cell phone. I still would talk to my friends on the phone and always felt in close enough touch with them. But I never felt the burning need as I was walking down the street to call up my best friend and say, by the way, I'm walking down the street. And so I think I can live as happily without the cell phone in that way now as I did 15 years ago.
What's the evidence? What are the indicators you see of some disenchantment with that complete digital embrace of people trying to disentangle themselves?
I have two friends who are journalists, as I am, who every weekend, religiously, as it were, practice an internet Sabbath. So they just cut off all internet connections between Friday night and Monday morning, just so they'll remember to talk around the dinner table or to do the things that they would have done 10 years ago but now have forgotten not to do. The family dinner, famously these days, is six people around a table, each concentrating on his own mobile phone or on his own laptop. I have other friends who will just take time every day to go running, to cook, to meditate, to do yoga. And I think as much as anything, the reason they're doing that is just to clear out some space when they can hear themselves think. And one of the things that most strikes me is that it's the people in the thick of the internet revolution and the people who are making all this possible to us who I think are most conscious of the dangers. So, for example, when I visited the Google campus a few years ago, as most people know by now, they have meditation rooms in one place, playrooms in another. They ensure that all their employees spend 20% of every week just having free time, because otherwise the employees wouldn't be able to bring anything to the company. Intel, in the same way 4 years ago, gave 300 of their managers and engineers 4 hours of mandated quiet time every week, in which they closed the door, couldn't take telephone calls, couldn't go online, and just had enough space to clear their heads and actually to be creative and to do the things that they were being paid for. Because I think studies have found now that the average worker at his job rarely gets more than 3 minutes of uninterrupted time without a chirp or a beep or whatever.
And speaking of people at the cutting edge, I mean, you write about resorts now, getaways in California, where people are paying more to be in what's called black hole resorts. That is, where there is no Wi-Fi, where there is no wireless connection, where there's no digital input or output.
Yes, that's right. People pay $2,000 a night to stay in a hotel precisely because it doesn't have television. Many writer friends now get this software called Freedom to disable the same internet connections that seemed so amazingly liberating 8 years ago. There are now internet rescue camps in places like South Korea and China, literally to help kids who have become addicted to the screen and who need to go cold turkey. I've noticed sometimes I'm walking down a street and I'll see a cafe with a big sign saying no Wi-Fi. And of course, I remember only 7 years ago, cafes were advertising that you could get online within them.
You quote the French philosopher Blaise Pascal saying, distraction is the only thing that consoles us for our miseries. The digital world certainly offers a lot of distraction, but you're also paying attention, and have for a long time now, to the great tradition of removing ourselves from the distractions of the world, even in quite pre-digital days, that kind of a cloister tradition or monastic tradition to get away from all that. What have we learned over the millennia about the value that lies in that vein of silence and retreat?
Maybe that it's only when you're not doing anything that you can understand what to do the rest of your life. And I think all of us have known that sensation of driving along a road. And if we don't completely trust our GPS, it's only when you pull off the road that you can see if you're going in the wrong direction or not. If you don't pull off, you could easily drive for another 500 miles and then find that you're much further from your destination than you want to be. And so I think, as you said, through millennia, people have always found that it's by stepping out of their lives and by stepping out of the world that they can best understand their lives and the world. And especially now, as we were saying, that the world is crashing in on us. It's almost as if we're standing 2 inches away from the world, and it's bombarding us, but we can't get the larger perspective. And if we can't get the larger perspective, we really don't know how to make sense of it. I think the great thing, interesting paradox of the information revolution is that it came without a manual. And the problems are not, as you said, with technology, but they're with the uses or misuses we make of them. Technology has given us the world, but it hasn't given us meaning. And it's given us this great freedom, but we have to set limits. And I think, as you were saying, what I do is every few months, even though I'm a fully functioning journalist, just to go to a monastery for a few days to clear my head, to understand what I should do with the next 3 months, and to be able to hear myself think. And often, the busier the moment in my life, the more important it is to do that. Somebody last week was telling me how Gandhi apparently once said, "This is a very busy day, so I should meditate 2 hours instead of one." And I sometimes feel the same way. This is a busy time in my life. I've just brought out this book. I have a lot of travel in front of me. I've been helping my mother and my wife organize long trips of their own. And precisely for that reason, I just spent the last 4 days in a monastery. And now I feel that I can much better deal with everything that comes up in my life.
You know, I can't tell if you're an early indicator, Pico, or if you're just off on your own moonbeam here. I'd see some evidence of people moving. I've got a teenage daughter who checked out of Facebook not long ago, and I thought, wow, that's counter trend, at least as we've known it over the last how many years. Now everybody was pouring into Facebook, maybe people ready to unplug. On the other hand, I mean, we touched this a little before, but, you know, all of the economic and social and almost hormonal motivations to be all wrapped up in the digital world right now. They're fierce. They're great. They're large, Pico.
You're absolutely right, Tom. And we can't uninvent what we've invented. We can't go backwards, and there's no value in it. And I think you used the word earlier in this program that is the key, which is balance. It's not that we want to be entirely unplugged or want to throw all our machines out of the window. It's just that we want to make our peace with them, and we want to know how they can best help us without deluging us and making us feel as if we are the tools of our tools. But I'm excited to hear about your daughter, and that's the kind of thing I'm hearing from a lot of my friends who are, of course, much older than your daughter, that I'm getting off Facebook. I'm limiting myself to just 1 hour a day online. I'm cutting down on my various interactions with the world in that form.
But then you're a guy who's never had a cell phone, so you're an outlier just from the get-go.
I'm the last one to talk on this.
the monastery-visiting, cell phone-less man who, at the same time, I mean, the other thing about you, we'll come back and talk about this, but I mean, you're a travel writer and a journalist. You're all over the world all the time. Just last year, here you are in Jerusalem, Hyderabad, Oman, St. Petersburg, Arkansas, Thailand, Fukushima, and Dubai. Hey, who needs a digital connection when you're physically going to all those places? Pico Iyer is with us. He's talking about the joy of quiet lately as a kind of respite, a kind of almost runaway from the digital realm. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. So tell me what it's gonna be, cause I got it all, shawty. You can gonna follow me, cause I know that, and you know that we can get it all. I swag, I surf, the net, it's worse. When I wake up, I hit that laptop first. I swag, I surf, the net, it's worse. When I wake up, I hit that laptop first. You the baddest, hit me on my Twitter page. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking today about walking away from the always-on digital world, unplugging, saying enough, saying no, with journalist, thinker, travel writer Pico Iyer. His new book is The Man Within My Head. Pico, lots of interesting response here. Leon says, unplug, it's barely legal. We've got Tom writing here on Facebook, sort of zen-like. He says, those that are not within are without. Mark says he sees cell phone zombies, sees them everywhere. They don't even know they're zombies. And what I had one more here saying, you know, maybe we should have Don Quixote on today. I guess the implication is this may be fruitless, maybe impossible. Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts is calling. Kevin, you're on with Pico Iyer.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Before you even started your show, I knew that I would agree with everything that your guest has to say, but unfortunately, I think the paradigm has shifted. He's referred to people becoming more conscious of this problem, but I think he's referring to much older people. In 1960, my father could much more easily turn the television off than I could when I was 5 years old, because he didn't grow up with the telephone. There's an entire generation of people now who know no other way. They can't walk down the street to the corner store without texting their friends, talking to their friends, listening to music plugged into their ears. I don't blame them. I'm sure I would have done the same thing had I been born this in this day and age. But it's not going to change for this generation. I'm 55 years old. I've recently become addicted to the On Point comment line and realized I have to take a step back.
Yeah.
I'm spending too much time here. I can do that. A 10-year-old who's had a cell phone his whole life and texted and played his games. Albert Einstein would never have come up with this general theory of relativity if he was born today, because he'd be too busy playing Angry Birds and texting Oppenheimer about what he had for lunch. And that's the nature of the beast. I don't believe the children of today or the last 10 or 15 years will ever give up these devices, because that's the life that they know.
Kevin, you may be right. Let's test that. I appreciate your call. Pico Iyer, let's just for a moment accept that notion. Let's say there's no going back for a generation that sort of comes up with these plugged in all the time. What if Kevin is right? What are the implications of that to you, Pico? And are we wrong to assume that, oh my God, down that road lies devastation? I mean, humans have adapted to many things.
They have, and I think it's just a case of getting a taste of something other than the life you know, whether it's for us who are in our 50s or for those kids who are in their teens. The reason that I first found out about this monastery, interestingly enough, was from a high school teacher here in Santa Barbara, who said that every spring he took his classes there. And he found that the most fidgety, distractible, hormone-addled, testosterone-driven 15-year-old boy had only to go to this place and just experience silence for a couple of days, and the boy felt much clearer and much happier, to the point where many of his students asked that they didn't want to come back after that. And, of course, that's only a couple of days in a year, and it shouldn't be more than a couple of days in a year. But my sense is that we're seeing diseases now like email apnea, internet addiction disorder, nomophobia, which is literally the fear of being out of mobile phone contact. And I wouldn't want kids to be living other than the way they are living. But I think just to open a small window in their consciousness and say, well, this is one thing you may want to try, and they don't have to love it. But many of them may see, well, maybe we could just spend 15 minutes every day going for a walk, clearing our heads, unplugging. Doesn't have to be more than that, but even those 15 minutes could make a radical difference.
Kelly in Colchester, Vermont. Kelly, you're on with Pico Iyer.
Hi, Tom. I am a college student at St. Michael's College, and I'm calling because I'm finding this topic pretty interesting. Last year, I was in a media class, and one of our assignments was to give up our cell phone, email, and Facebook for an entire week. And we actually had to hand in our cell phone to our professor, who kept it in a locked drawer.
Okay.
And it was quite the week.
Kelly, how old are you, if I may ask?
22.
22. And how was that week without cell phone, email, text, the rest?
At first, it was uncomfortable. I found myself automatically going to reach for my cell phone when it wasn't even in the same vicinity as
the
me.
The phantom phone, yep.
Yeah, I went to, my homepage used to be Facebook. So that popped up on my laptop, and I was like, okay, well, I have to get rid of this. Mm-hmm. So it was hard at first, and then by the middle of the week, it was really relaxing. You know, I didn't feel like I had to check my phone every 5 minutes. Finally, the phantom vibrations stopped. So it was a good week. It was nice to know that I didn't need to have my email, my cell phone, and Facebook.
So you tasted the serenity of being unplugged, but how much time in your life do you think that's going to be the case? I assume when that week was over, everybody in class, jumped right back on and was off to the races again.
Yeah, I since that week, I've actually turned my phone onto silent. I turn my phone silent about an hour before I go to bed, and I keep it on silent actually most of the time. Because I don't like feeling like I have to be a slave to my cell phone. There are times when my mom will call me and she will leave a message because it's on silent and I don't have it on me. And she gets upset, why didn't you pick up your phone? You're worrying me. Like, Mom, right. It's your cell phone. I'm fine.
Right.
It's just on silent.
Kelly, it sounds like you found a little place of peace in that arc of digital life. And we wish you good luck with that. Pico Iyer, stand by if you would. I want to bring another voice into our conversation for a moment here from Culver City, California. Musical Mimi Ito joins us. She's research director for the Digital Media and Learning Hub, professor of anthropology and informatics at the University of California Humanities Research Institute, co-author of the studies Living and Learning with New Media, and author of Hanging Out. Mimi Ito, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We think of humans as almost endlessly vulnerable to addiction in the digital realm. Is there some kind of auto-resistance that kicks in at a certain point? What are you seeing? Are we just getting deeper and deeper into all things digital, or is there a pushback vein that's alive and kicking too?
Well, I think the research is definitely showing, especially among youth, that they are indeed living in an era with more and more saturation of media and communications. But I think our research is also showing that there is a trend towards people recognizing the fact that they have to take more personal responsibility for their media and communication choices. And even among young people, as with, the corporate sector that I think Pico rightly noted, young people are developing a ton of interesting strategies for managing that connection and disconnection, but the ways in which they're dealing with it are still incredibly diverse, and I think it's very important that we have exactly this kind of conversation about how we can move into a space where it's not about technology determining our choices, about us taking responsibility for how we manage that.
What's stronger, Mimi, the internal urge to go on and get that little, I don't know what it is, hit of satisfaction from seeing stuff online that pushes us to our digital realm, or the social expectation of others, like Kelly's mother or people's friends, that you will be there, so you'd better be there?
Right, right. Well, I think it's a combination of both, just because, you know, there's a ton of things ranging from wanting to access entertainment, which is often about personal engagement and interest, and other things that are more socially driven. So I think also, you know, the strategies have to change depending on that. And it reminds me a lot of, you know, when in modern society we've had an abundance of food choices and abundance of calories in a way that has really forced us to look at our diets and our choices about food in new ways. And I think, you know, for teaching young people and for those of us in adulthood, we develop very complex strategies for managing access to healthy food, and we need to do the same for media and information.
Pico, do you think it's possible that humans actually, despite our images of retreat and monastery and cloister, maybe it's possible once we've revved up for the digital world to be on and at the same time, to be plugged in, but at the same time, Pico, so zen that we can be on plus chill and reflective and meditative? Is that possible? We could do all that?
Oh, absolutely. I love what Mimi said, and I do think we have a self-regulating mechanism. Many a time somebody has given me a huge bag of corn chips and I've gone right the way through it in 10 minutes, quickly got a headache or a stomach ache and learned my lesson and realized next time eat half the bag. And I think all of us do that all the time with everything that's presented with us. And I love the fact that kids today will find each one their own way of coming to a healthy balance. And Kelly, I think, was sent from central casting in that way in terms of my prejudices. And one of the things I loved what she was talking about was before going to bed. And I, just like all the rest of us, used to scroll through YouTubes or watch TV before going to bed. And I noticed that my sleep was very jangled and jittery. And then a couple of times I thought, well, why don't I just have a conversation with a friend or take a walk around the block or just listen to some music for half an hour before I sleep. And instantly it seemed to me my sleep and my dreams and my waking up the next day was better. And so, yes, I think inevitably humans are going to be more and more connected, but equally inevitably, they're always going to have to find their own way of carving out a sanctuary in the middle of that connectedness. Otherwise, they will lose their sanity.
Let's hear from a few more listeners. Caitlin in Boston. Caitlin, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to call. I'm 27, and I grew up sort of as all of this social networking exploded. I was a college student in Boston when Facebook came about, and I'm finding myself pulling away as I'm currently going through a breakup, and I've been reflecting on how it's very emotionally challenging to live in a world where we're not only tempted to but invited to look at exes' wedding pictures and births of children. And I was having a conversation recently with my mother, who's not even quite 50, and she just was sort of appalled that that was something that we have to go through as a generation. Now it's challenging enough to be plugged in all the time in work, but for it to sort of tug at your heartstrings is a new challenge that I don't know if anyone has really experienced before on this level.
That is really interesting. In the middle of a romantic breakup, but the other person, even their lives, even the intimate pieces of their lives don't go away just because you've broken up. I mean, Pico, talk about getting right into the middle of our psyches. You know, when Caitlin's online, that person who in most ways is out of her life remains in her life. In the old days, that would be called haunting or something, wouldn't it?
Yes, and that's why one of the most current recent phrases is too much information, because that's exactly what we're suffering from at every level. But you're right, nothing gets deleted. The whole of our life is in our rooms all the time. And it's also like having 6 billion people in our bedrooms wherever we are. And as Caitlin said so touchingly, that's much more than we want often.
Mimi, where do you think humans will come down? You know, we've had a kind of big party around the digital realm for 10, 20 years now at least. Where it's been mainly celebration and people taking on more and more and more threads and ties to the digital realm. If you had to guess, will we continue? Will we just develop more and more capacity to be plugged in all the time? Or do you think we'll gear back to some more modulated relationship with the digital realm?
Yeah, I mean, I think that most of us don't really want to completely unplug or to roll back the clock to a period when, like, a long-distance call was a luxury or we had to trek to the library to look up something on an encyclopedia. I think there's a driving human need for connection, for access to knowledge and information that's pretty resilient. At the same time, I do think that we're already seeing a lot of experimentation, conversation, educational programs developing around these issues of how to manage attention, how to manage access to information. For example, one of my colleagues, Howard Rheingold, has been talking about the need for what he calls infotension, and different tools and strategies that you can use to manage access to information in ways that really make you happy and productive rather than distracted and frustrated. And I think within the educational sector, we're also seeing a lot more programs about educating kids about information literacy and policies like appropriate times for lids down, no laptops in the classroom. We've even seen teachers blocking Wi-Fi for certain moments in order to manage attention in particular ways. So I think those kinds of strategies, those kinds of social norms and policies will continue to grow.
Lids down. Mimi Ito, we're glad you and others are working on it and thinking about it. Mimi Ito's book is Hanging Out, Messing Around, Geeking Out, Kids Living and Learning with New Media. She's joined us from Culver City, California. Mimi, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Chris in Toronto. Chris, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hello. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
And thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes.
And I'd just like to take a moment to plug WNEB and in Buffalo. That's where I pick you guys up from.
Okay.
But anyway, regarding this topic of being plugged in, I'm a bit of an old fart. I've been at this since 1968 and early 70s when disk drives were the size of a washing machine and had punch cards. But what I really wanted to say was during the late 70s, I took a little course called The Time Trap. And I really think it involves down to the point where people just don't know how to manage their time. People get so plugged in that I've got to instantly respond to everything that's coming my way. You don't have to. Put it down. Call back 4 hours later. Just get back to them today in a business environment. You don't have to solve the problem. You just got to manage your time.
So, but you, Chris, you said you're not a kid anymore. If you were, do you think you could have that same attitude? Or, you know, if you're out sort of looking to a career started, get a life started, it might be brave to say, no, I'm just not in that instant response realm.
I think that may be a problem with a lot of kids that are that way. But if they're given a little training in the very beginning that I don't have to respond just because somebody talks to me, they might learn how to handle it a little bit better. And it gives them a little bit more free time. I can call them back in 3 hours instead of 30 seconds. Because one thing we found out in the business environment, if we flashed information back at a user too quickly, they didn't respond properly. They didn't take time to think about what they were looking at.
Yeah, so take your time. In a way, manage expectations toward a little bit of a slower pace. Chris, I appreciate that from Toronto. Pico, we'll come back and look at this. We'll come back and think about Graham Greene for a minute. It's great to have you with us. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about walking away from the always-on digital world. Unplugging, saying enough, saying no with journalist, thinker, travel writer Pico Iyer. His new book is The Man Within My Head, a kind of memoir and meditation on Graham Greene. We'll talk about that. He joins us today from Santa Barbara, California. And we're really talking maybe about unplugging, maybe about balance. What do you think? Are we near it? Are you moving away from always-on digital status? Are we learning something on that front? Pico, we've got lots of interesting response here. One, Lynn is rents cabins in upstate New York in the Adirondacks, and she's listening very closely to your story about California retreats that are charging more for rooms or accommodations without Wi-Fi. She says that's what they've got already. Maybe they should charge more, you know, make it an added attraction to be off. And here's Jeff writes. He said, have you heard of the new practice of phone piling? When people go out to eat, I guess to a restaurant, everyone piles their phones in a place where everyone can see them, and then they start the meal. Then as the phones start vibrating, chirping, or ringing, whoever picks up their phone first has to pay for all the meals. Sounds like, I mean, that is in some way, Pico, what you're talking about. People are plugging into the fact that maybe we shouldn't all be chattering away in our own little box.
At least not 24 hours a day. And, you know, Tom, I loved what you said about the fact that if I were 21 years old tomorrow and graduating from college, I would need to have a huge digital presence. I would need to be keeping up with what's going on. I would need to be as plugged in as possible. But if I went for a job interview and I were to say, I just spent a week walking in the Sierras without any cell phone contact, or that every day I run for 30 minutes just to clear my head and to hear myself think, I bet a prospective interviewer would actually be taken aback and maybe impressed and think, well, this is a guy who actually has something to offer. He needs to be super plugged in, but he needs at times to step away from that.
I mean, there is some irony here. You know, we are a show that operates in so many media now, you know, a Facebook presence and Twitter and people listening online. We're happy for that connection. At the same time, and we get a tweet here from E.F. Sweetman says, this is an observation by his 17-year-old niece. And this points, Pico, to you may be onto something in this trend here. She says, 17 years old, if you don't have a life on Facebook, it means you have a life off Facebook. That's the kind of value of the unplugged life ethic rising up, it sounds to me, Pico.
Yes, and because I think all of us sense, however young, that the only way we can do justice to our online self is being offline. That the only way you can find the wisdom, the clarity, the emotional direction to make the best use of your Facebook page or whatever your interactions are is by being away from them, at least for a short time.
We heard that beautiful Japanese shakuhachi music going out of the last segment, and that left me really thinking about the great, long, deep human tradition of unplugging even before we had all these voracious digital devices. I mean, just from regular life, regular old-fashioned life, people found value in moving to something closer to stillness or to stillness itself, Pico.
Yes, I mean, why 150 years later do people still read books like Walden? I think precisely because Henry David Thoreau pointed out that even then there was a great quantity of connections and new telecommunication or new telegraph system and trains linking people together, but that bore no relation to the quality of connections. And finally, what sustains us is not the amount of people we're in touch with, but the depth of the contact that we have with them. And one way or another, life brings that lesson to us, whether we want it to or not.
Fran in Acton, Massachusetts. Fran, you're on the air with Pico Iyer.
It just occurs to me sometimes that this perspective is a bit privileged and a bit unrealistic from the perspective of myself, a mother, trying to start a small business, in terms of the time that's spent in response to Pico's earlier comment that said, oh, it's a busy day, so I need to meditate twofold.
Yeah, right.
And it's sort of a very privileged perspective, and I just wonder, especially in this economy, people are just trying to do what they have to do and, raise their kids. And I think that the woman's voice and women still are doing more the share of the mundane here in our culture, and that and sort of the day-to-day tasks are heaped on women in a different way than men. And I just wanted to...
And you have a sense, Fran, I take it, that the digital connections help you get all things done, starting a business, staying on top of what matters to the family.
I think it, for sure, but I'm pretty metered in how I interface with social media, precisely because I do crave the silence. I do crave a balance with the life outside of Facebook. So I took a fast from Facebook right after Thanksgiving until the new year, and my post coming back to Facebook was meh. And it sort of made me realize I valued so much the time with my friends and family and the time to write letters and all this thing, but But my point is, the bigger quandary is sort of, how can, you know, a travel writer, male travel writer from Santa Barbara, be speaking to how to, solutions to the problems of like a more feminist issues. That
the young mom starting a business with a baby on her hip, and we can hear it. Fran, let us pick it up. I mean, Pico, okay, you know, there was Siddhartha. He went and sat under the Bodhi tree, became the Buddha. But he was a prince. He was privileged. He could sit under the Bodhi tree. Is that what it takes?
I love what Fran said. And I think just my sense is that when I wake, you know, I'm struggling to survive as everybody else is. And when I wake up, if I go right to my desk or my kids or my wife or my bosses, I'm flustered and agitated and jangled. And I feel that I'm not really giving them something very useful. I'm giving them my distractedness and my frenzy. And we all have maybe 12 hours of the day in which we have a huge number of duties to take care of. And sometimes by stepping aside for one of those hours, we can do much more with 11 hours than we would otherwise have 12. And I think what Fran said about being metered is really the perfect answer to all the things that we're discussing, that that she clearly has found the ideal way to deal with this torrent of daily challenges and still keep calm. And I think that's what each one of us is trying to do.
Maybe it's ideal. People just trying chance writes. There's certainly a shift taking place with younger folks' chance writes. While my wife and I are both guilty of iPhone staring, and I guess we know what that is, you know, alone together, sitting together, each staring off into their own screen, we find ourselves wishing for simplicity and quiet more and more. It's a fascinating tension. Chris in Somerville, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, I started keeping Shabbat. I'm 27, 28 years old. I'm right at that point where I was 13 when I started instant messaging and the internet became my life.
Right.
And by 28, it was too much. And so a couple of years ago, I just let it all go.
And when you say you're keeping Shabbat, so it's a Jewish Sabbath, what from Friday evening to Saturday
Jewish
evening,
Sabbath,
you're
Saturday
off the...
to Saturday at sunset. I get off work at 4:30, so it's in the dead of winter. It's a little bit later, but I come home, I light candles, I pray, I drink a glass of wine, I look at the candles, and everything's off for 24 hours.
Including all your digital devices? No cheating, Chris?
Especially my digital devices. And the first time that I put off the digital devices, I remember I went, I'm going to be offline for 24 hours. I'm going to be offline for 24 hours. And in 24 hours, nothing happened.
Right.
And I got back, and it was, and whatever was happening in those 24 hours will still be there.
Has that 24 hours away helped you kind of modulate your use through the rest of the week? Does it give you a little distance or a feeling of command rather than being a slave of the thing?
And weeks that I can't do it because I visit my sister in New York, or I go and I get in a car to go on a trip or something, or something happens in the family and I have to go, I definitely feel a difference in my week. Those 24 hours definitely are like pressing the reset button. And I think however you do it, from the woman that has the kids and modulates from, and my friends even that respond immediately to my Twitter, like when I'll tweet them, they're like, oh my God, it's been 6 hours. I'm sorry I didn't respond immediately. When I say it's okay to not respond immediately, I can almost feel them being better.
Yeah. Chris, I'm so glad to hear that, and thank you for sharing that. Pico, I can kind of feel something rising up here. I mean, I think you're on to something. People, whether it's with Shabbat or just a personal decision or a retreat or just the modulation mindset, there seems to be a kind of pushback here.
Yes, and I think Shabbat or the Bodhi tree or the Catholic retreat house are all wonderful examples of how our religions for hundreds of years have made sure that there are ways for us to contact our deepest part. And we humans have some longing for that, that if we're running along the surface and zipping from the grocery store to the bank to the post office to the playground or whatever, something in us feels it's not being fulfilled and satisfied, and something else in us tries to create a way to make sure that those deeper parts do have access.
You interact with an awful lot of people. Do you think it's possible that we're hearing little glimpses of it today, that a new sort of status or standing will be associated with non-instantaneous response to digital communication? You know, that people who are not instantly coming right back to you will be seen as those, I don't know, with more moral fiber or more kind of grounded lives.
It may take a while, though, because, of course, I find I'm always very agitated if I get lots of emails, but I'm even more agitated if I don't get lots of emails and if the person
I wrote to
hasn't answered. Right. So even I am, you know, a perfect example of what not to do. One other thing I noticed, though, about my traveling is that those countries that are very oppressed or impoverished, like Cuba or Burma or Tibet, there, of course, cell phones and digital technology are giving them freedom and knowledge and a sense of possibility that they could never get otherwise. And I think it can't be overstated how much the internet revolution has helped people in very difficult circumstances. I think it's more those of us in the US tend to have quite a bit of mobility often and quite a lot of data. And it's we who, I think, may not need it as much as we think we do.
One more call. Beth in Earhart, South Carolina. Beth, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
For me, it's Facebook is somewhat a therapeutic device for me. I suffer from severe clinical depression, and I've had the internet for less than a year now.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times before that I would not even open my front door, or I could go for quite some time without any interaction with other humans at all. Now, I understand, of course, Facebook isn't anywhere near the same as face-to-face and
sure.
talking with someone in person,
mm-hmm.
but it's helped me with the depression.
There you go. Beth, I appreciate your call. I mean, Pico, people have all kinds of interactions here. In Beth's case, it may be a lifeline.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the technology we're talking about has, in many cases, made our lives longer, healthier, better, brighter. It's a wonderful example of how it has opened a door in Beth's life that perhaps would have been closed otherwise. I, myself, could not live in rural Japan and send all my articles to my bosses in New York City without email. So I'm as dependent as anybody and as grateful as anybody for what technology has given. And it's always a good thing to be reminded of the ways in which our lives have improved as well as sometimes got more challenged thanks to technology.
Hey, Pico, turn a corner with us for a moment here because you've written interestingly with your new book out about Graham Greene, the guy you called, you know, the writer, not the writer you dreamed of becoming, but that he was part of everything you were trying to put behind you. What brought Graham Greene into your, life, your focus? Why are you tying almost a memoir up with meditations on this British writer?
I suppose the fact that everywhere I went, whether I was walking down the street or suddenly arriving in Saigon at the dead of night, I found that I was walking through a Graham Greene novel, that somehow again and again my life corresponded almost uncannily with things that I would find or had found in his books. I would meet somebody called Fong and I would pick up a book and that was by Graham Greene, and it was about somebody called Fong. I would read a biography about Graham Greene, and there he was confessing to a priest called Father Pilkington, and then I would remember the man in charge of me for 4 years growing up was a Father Pilkington, not a very common name. And so I began almost to wonder, first, am I just a figment of Graham Greene's imagination? Is he scripting my life? But also, just to be interested in this sense that all of us, I think, have these characters in our heads that perhaps we've never met, but somehow we feel closer to them than to many of the people around us. And we almost feel as if they understand us better than our friends and family do. And I know with some of my friends, they listen to Joni Mitchell records and they think, my goodness, she's been reading my diary. She knows my innermost secrets. Or they'll read a Henry James novel and they'll say, how does he know every last detail of what I'm going to do today? And so I thought it would be an interesting thing to investigate, who are these people in our heads? What are they doing there? And why this person, whom I never would have chosen as a kind of kindred spirit or an alter ego, but why everywhere in my life, wherever I go, do I find Graham Greene like a shadow by my side?
He traveled the world in his day, brought certain attitudes to that travel, and I suppose developed certain attitudes and perspectives on humanity and life in the world in those travels. You travel an awful lot as well. We heard that list from just last year. How do you think your perspective on humanity in the world compares after all your travels with Graham Greene's after your meditation here?
I think anybody who travels quickly sees that Graham Greene got some of the moral and emotional challenges of being in a difficult place as well as anybody has ever done. And I think one of the things that's so touching to me about him is he always stressed kindness. And he had a very vexed relationship with Catholicism, and he didn't really know if he believed or didn't believe. But he always said that regardless of what you believe or don't believe, you have the capacity to give kindness to the people around you at every moment. And that that was really much more important than the ways you defined it yourself. And I think when you're walking down the street, as I often have been in Rangoon or Havana or Beirut, and suddenly a stranger comes up with a request, how do I respond to that request? How do I know whether to trust that person or not? The only guidebook I can turn to in those circumstances is usually a Graham Greene novel.
He may have been kind, but he had a pretty jaundiced eye. Has your eye been jaundiced by your years of travel?
Well, I would say he has an eye attuned to ambiguity. He didn't believe in answers, and he had a very keen sense of questions. So I wouldn't want it to be jaundiced, and I wouldn't want even to say that he is jaundiced, but I would say undeluded. And I think one of the things that moves me is that, as you suggest, he really saw the world as it is and traveled hard in order to see exactly what was going on. But he never lost faith in it, and he never lost hope in it. And his classic character is somebody who does everything wrong and commits every sin in the book, but at the critical moment rises to some degree of self-sacrifice or kindness, almost saintliness, that even that person didn't expect. And I think that's actually rather inspiring for those of us who are not saints.
Pico Iyer, on both these fronts, the digital life plugged in and unplugged, and also on your meditation on Graham Greene in the new book, The Man Within My Head, we're grateful for your insights on both, and a real pleasure to have you with us today. Come again, and thanks a lot for joining us, Pico.
Thank you so much.
On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gelrosen, Ping Wang, Alina Mata, Alex Kingsbury, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Medina Roshan and Lucas Shepner. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.